now?
Well, actually, none of my journalism experience, really, other than some part-time stuff now, is in Oregon. But for about 30 years, I was a newspaper reporter and editor everywhere, starting in high school back in Detroit, Michigan, and then moving on as a career. But for the past 12 years, we've been living in rural Washington County, writing history books, mostly about Washington County, but this is our fourth history book. This one really expands well beyond Washington County. It covers the entire Oregon Territory and the state of Oregon. But really the incident we're going to focus on today just happens to have been a murder trial in Washington County that kind of illustrates many of the most significant points of the death penalty.
How did you find out about this murder trial?
Well, as I mentioned, this is our fourth history book. And my wife, Chris, spends hundreds of hours research. We both do, but Chris spends the bulk of it. Hundreds of hours of research, largely of newspaper archives, not surprisingly, since that's my background. And so we started by searching for stories specific to Gaston, which is the small town we live nearby. But since then, it's just grown and expanded. And you never know what you're going to find when you're going through all the old historical newspapers. And we stumbled upon this case.
What about this case that brought you to write this section of the book specifically about this murder trial, this hanging?
Well, because the murder itself took place in 1895. And as you probably know, the state of Oregon became a state in 1859. And so we started tracing all the executions, the legal executions in the state of Oregon. And there were a lot of issues with the death penalty. You know, we have this impression that back in the Wild West, justice was just swift and sure. You know, you killed a man, they hanged you. In many cases, that's true. And in fact, especially in places like Eastern Oregon and Southern Oregon, often the hanging would take place within hours of the murder because the justice system wasn't even often involved. Or, as we would find sometimes, if a marshal or sheriff did arrest a person, they would conveniently forget to lock up the jail and vigilantes would come and do the deed themselves. But there's another side of the death penalty in early Oregon, and that is that while justice could be swift and sure, sometimes justice was also delayed, sometimes it was denied, and even when somebody was convicted of a murder, often the sentences turned out to be incredibly short. And not surprisingly, a lot of what determined whether it was swift and sure or long and delayed involved things like race and class. So you could pretty well bet that if a black person or Native American were accused of murdering somebody, especially a white person, then that's the kind of case where it rarely even made it to court before they were hanged. But there are other issues involved besides the fact that there's the issue of class, for example, and but there were other reasons why justice sometimes wasn't delivered very fairly. And some of it just had to do with the fact, if you think about crime scene investigation, it didn't exist in the 1800s. If you think about when this murder we're going to talk about happened, 1895, that was the heyday of Sherlock Holmes. But Sherlock Holmes, especially in places like rural Oregon, that was just science fiction. None of that existed. Typically, if you didn't have eyewitnesses or a confession, you just couldn't convict somebody. And jurors knew that. And so in many cases, jurors took the side of the accused. There's an element of common law called Blackstone's theorem that basically it's better that 100 guilty people go free than that one innocent man suffer. And that was taken very seriously among many of the settlers. They didn't trust law enforcement for the most part. And if you didn't have really an airtight case, it often resulted either in an acquittal or a hung jury or an almost instant commutation of the sentence.
So if I am accused as a young white man in the early part of the 20th or later part of the 19th century, what do you assume would happen if no one saw, no witnesses, and there was just blood everywhere instead?
You know, I won't say there was no crime scene investigation, but about as sophisticated as it could get would be that maybe they'd find like a bloody footprint. And mm-hmm. if they did eventually find a suspect, they could say, well, it looks like it's about the same size boot that the suspect wears. But typically, what we found is, for example, leading up to this particular murder that we're going to talk about, I will get to it, I promise, about 8 consecutive murders in Washington County went completely unsolved. Either because 6 or 8, either because nobody ever found a suspect, that, you know, they'd find a body, but there was no clear motive, there was no suspect. So there are a number of cases where people have no clue why the murder happened or who did it. In other cases, it was pretty, you know, people had pretty clear suspicions of who did it, but either they couldn't prove it. Or the other thing you have to remember in the Old West is that you could disappear almost in plain sight because you didn't have computers to track you, you didn't have that sort of thing. So if you got on the lam quickly enough, you didn't have to go too many miles away before nobody would ever find you. And we're going to touch on that element too when we start talking about this case of John Ledrick.
In this issue that they've had for law enforcement, specifically this hanging that you're talking about with me today, what was the consensus in the crime scene when they came to it? Was it a difficult one to assess?
Well, first of all, it was difficult because a popular farmer by the name of John Ledrick, who lived just south of Cornelius on Iowa Hill, went missing. And the sheriff investigated, and they couldn't even find the body for about 2 weeks, several days anyways. Until a dog found the body buried under a pile of manure. And, of course, by that time, the clues were gone. It looked like there was a suspect because the farmer who died had been in a grazing dispute with a neighbor farmer. And grazing disputes were one of the three things that prompted most murders back in 1800s Oregon were gambling women and grazing disputes. And so he was a clear suspect, but they had nothing directly to tie it to him. And there's another issue that complicates some of these investigations back then, and that is at the time of this murder, for example, the sheriff of Washington County did not get paid a salary. He got paid bounties, basically, on if he arrested a suspect, if he collected back taxes, if he served legal papers on something. But he didn't get paid hourly or yearly. So every hour he spent trying to investigate and crack a difficult case was an hour that he wasn't making any money. So that's another reason why sometimes these cases went unsolved, just because there was so little incentive to put the time and effort into solving them. So I think, as I mentioned, the Ledrick murder, I think I said 1895. It was actually 1894.
All right.
But this was a time when, like I say, law enforcement really was not trusted very well. And to give you an idea of the distrust that people had in law enforcement and why there were so many vigilante groups and that sort of thing, if we look at two other cases just real quickly, one was the case of a man in a cabin over in the Coast Range near Tillamook, and his wife and daughter were both chopped up with axes and then were burned in a wood stove. And this might not have even come to light except that the house caught on fire and burned to the ground. Well, it was pretty cut and dry. They had the guy pretty much dead to rights. It was a gruesome murder scene, but his name was Absalom Hembry and Jr. And his father actually was one of the founding fathers of Oregon and was extremely well connected. He was Oregon's only fatality in the Cayuse Wars up in Washington, so he was a war hero, his father. And even though they managed to convict his son, Hembry, for these just gruesome crimes, he ended up plea bargaining down to manslaughter and spent a grand total of 365 days in jail for the death of two people. That caused an intense amount of outrage around the county and around the state. And we had another case in Forest Grove of another woman who ended up dead. It's a very long, convoluted story. The woman ended up dead. She was the ex-wife of a state senator. Turns out that shortly before she died, the state senator's 19-year-old daughter had died under very mysterious circumstances. And a year or two later, the state senator's new wife died under very unusual and suspicious circumstances. So you have the three women closest to this state senator all dying under extremely unusual and suspicious circumstances, and no charges were ever brought. So we're in this era of distrust with law enforcement, and to some extent law enforcement distrusted itself because, you know, they so often their efforts ended up going nowhere that, again, there was actually a fair amount of incentive to not even try.
Do people feel this way maybe today? Sometimes, even with all the differences we have in our technology and our social awareness maybe being adjusted so that we have VAWA, Violence Against Women Act, and also have had different ages that we've worked through different protests and activism where we've changed other laws in order to make it so we can do different things. We have similar mistrust, obviously, of law enforcement. We still don't trust law enforcement to not shoot someone, for example, if they are of color, as much as we would of a white person if they were in the same circumstances.
Well, and certainly, you know, my focus is on the past, and I'm not an expert on sociology, but I certainly think we can see parallels here when you do talk about things like the shootings of unarmed black men. You know, the great divide in the country, the intense distrust in some quarters and the intense trust, if you will, in others. I think that clearly you could see sort of the same sort of things going on where different people felt back in the day that they were essentially discriminated against because of their economic status or really more often than not their ethnic or racial status. And to give you just an example of that, and we talked about Absalom Hembree, who butchered his wife and daughter and spent 365 days in jail. The last public execution in the city of Portland was actually of a black man, and it happened after public hanging supposedly had been outlawed, but they made just shortly before. But they made an exception in this particular case. It was a man who also had murdered his wife. But the key difference was that the man was black and the wife was white. And there was no 365 days in jail for the black man who killed his white wife. He was hanged in just a horrible spectacle in downtown Portland with hundreds of cheering people in attendance and that sort of thing. So clearly there has always been a sense, Oregon and elsewhere, that the death penalty and criminal justice in general are applied unevenly based on things like race and class.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Tim DeChristopher Lecture, Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, Thursday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Tim DeChristopher, as Bitter 70, disrupted a Bureau of Land Management oil and gas auction in 2008 by outbidding oil companies for land parcels around Arches and Canyonlands National Parks in Utah. His actions led to a 21-month imprisonment. Again, that's a lecture by Tim DeChristopher titled Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, Thursday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
A Washington Post investigation revealed that of all fatal shootings by police in 2015, almost one quarter involved a person who was mentally unstable. Tune in to Prison Pipeline on April 4th to hear St. Helens Police Chief Terry Moss discuss how crisis intervention training is changing how police interact with people with mental illness and how police are helping to divert them from incarceration. That's Prison Pipeline, April 4th at 6:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Climate Change Tools for Faith Communities, a workshop led by Tim DeChristopher, Saturday, April 9th, starting at 10 a.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. During this day-long workshop, Sewell Lecture Speaker Tim DeChristopher will share integrated and multi-faith strategies to prevent climate change and environmental injustice, combat poverty, and restore dignity to both people and the planet. Again, that's a Climate Change Tools for Faith Communities, a workshop led by Tim DeChristopher, Saturday, April 9th at 10 a.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's 6 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Holla! Welcome to the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists segment of Labor Radio, highlighting the works of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class, here on KBOO 90.7 FM, where the heart of the community